the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Thank you, Marie. Right. It is lovely to see you all tonight and to, on this slightly rainy evening, get to spend some time together in this chapter of Exodus. I'm imagining for most of you that it is a story that you are familiar with. And as we go through it and we look at God's gift of manna and we see his faithfulness in leading and feeding the Israelites, I'd like to focus on how the Israelites and how we are, I think, called to respond as we see and experience God's provision and challenge. That they and we are called to rely, but also to remember. Over the series, if you've been with us in the past few weeks, we've spent a lot of time with the Israelites. I'd like to think that we've got to know them quite well. And I think in this chapter, it would be quite easy to fall into a little bit of despair, to see them and their grumbling as kind of hopeless and hapless. I don't know about you, but I just want to kind of sigh, throw my hands in the air and go, oh, can't you just trust God at points? And yes, there's an extent to which that is an appropriate response. As a people, they have literally just experienced God move powerfully. They've witnessed the plagues and the Passover. They've walked through parted water and they've seen drinking water turn from bitter to sweet. Can't they see the God who has been with them all of that time? Surely they've got it by now. But the problems that they are facing in this moment, in this passage, are still real. And their grumbling, I think, comes from a place of enormous fear. Most of us are hugely fortunate with the resources we have and the lives that we live. And it's important as we read this passage that we don't lose sight of the reality that this is thousands of people in the desert with nothing to eat. Their hunger and their fear were as real as any that we will ever face. And if we miss that and sweep it under the carpet with a shrug and a, oh, honestly, just stop moaning, we not only miss the reality of their situation, but also the extent of God's provision in it. We miss that God hears all of our fears and our grumbling and meets them with faithful provision. In fact, God hears and responds to the Israelites' grumbling, even when at face value it's not directed at him. It's Moses and it's Aaron who the Israelites turn the heat of their words on, that it would have been better if they had stayed as slaves in Egypt, because there they had food. And it's not only Moses who is clear about the real object of their complaints. He says, "Who are we? You're not grumbling against us, but against the Lord." But also God himself sees that it's not really Moses and Aaron who the Israelites are taking this problem up with. He chooses to listen, to lead, and to feed. He hears the pain, he hears the fear, and he responds. It would be, I think, too easy to see the grumbling of the Israelites as only displeasing to God. Because probably, if we're honest, that's our human response. But it's not how God responds. Verse 9 tells us that the people were to come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. And then that there was the glory of the Lord. Much of this passage, I think, focuses on the daily reliance on God that the Israelites have to build. But it's important to notice first that it comes from a place of meeting God. Of meeting a God who hears their pain, sees their reality, and then shows his character and his glory. Before they and before we can rely on God, we have to have met him. We have to know that He is the safest, most secure place to put our lives. We have to have seen His glory. And I think it shows that the first step to reliance on God is acknowledging that He is where we should take our pain, our fear, our grumbling. We can't rely on Him for any of the things that we're about to turn to without first relying on Him to take the weight of our grumbling. But it's not only that that the Israelites learn to rely on God for here. As is often the case, I think, it's the Israelites' immediate physical needs that are at the top of their priority list. And it isn't a small thing that they need. Food for thousands of people for as long as their journey will last. And I think it's interesting that in all of the grumbling we have recorded here, and I would imagine they haven't written down every bit of moaning that the Israelites do. I think this is a snapshot of a lot of complaining about their situation. At no point do they directly ask God for food. Their point is that it was better where they were before. Can't they go back to Egypt? At no point do they say, God, what we need here is food. And I wonder, kind of as a slight aside, whether there are similar things that we collectively, individually, are spending our mental energy worrying about and thinking about, but aren't actually directly bringing before God and saying, God, this is what I need from you. Are there things that we are carrying that weight, that we are grumbling and moaning about without turning them to God? But what I think is reassuring, because I'm sure it's something we all do, is that even though these grumbles and fears and pain are not turned directly to God, He still hears them and sees them. And His response, we're told, is so that they might know who He is. Verse 13 tells us, that evening quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. I'm fairly confident that's not what the Israelites had in mind. It's not what they envisaged when they were thinking about how much food they needed. I love the fact that they looked at manna, pointed at it and went, what's that? And then that's what they called it for the rest of the time. I think that's how we should name more things, if I'm honest. What is that? I don't know. And putting aside the concerns that I would definitely have about eating the same dewy bread and quail every day for 40 years, I'm not sure I could even eat chocolate for that much time. This is still divine and abundant provision. It might not have looked how the Israelites expected. It might not be how we would design it, but it is still divine and abundant provision. What started off as a very human, we need food now, became God's here is food that will sustain many of you for the rest of your lives. Here is food that will see you through this whole journey. God's provision may not always be what or how we expect, but that doesn't make it any less good. And God's faithful leading and feeding of the Israelites doesn't only result in abundant provision for their physical needs. In fact, the whole rhythm of manna is built around provision of a different kind. In setting out the Sabbath day of rest as a day where there will already be enough to eat, where the work, the physical needs will already have been met, God is taking away their focus on the physical in order to place it on the spiritual and their relationship with Him. Moses and the Lord are very clear in their conversation about how this will work. Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. That is why on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where they are on the seventh day. No one is to go out. So the people rested on the seventh day. Here is your provision. Here is what you need to get you to a place that you can just be with me. God provides the physical provision in order to then be able to meet their spiritual needs. Here we see a God who prioritizes rest, presence, and relationship, and wants to build it into the daily lives of his people. And in the same way, we are called to rely on God, not only for our physical needs, but also our spiritual. And if we choose to ignore, or maybe more often to squeeze out the space that we have, the time that we have to feed our spiritual needs, if we squeeze down that time and reduce it out, then we are choosing to rely on our own strength and not the faithful leading and feeding of God. It seems to be kind of human nature that we're not great at relying on something when it becomes too easy to think that we could do it on our own. I've just realised how in keeping with this little anecdote is, but clearly I had bread on the brain. It's a little bit like when I bake bread. We have a bread maker, which I use on a fairly regular basis, and I enjoy doing it. It fills the house with a lovely smell. And for months, every loaf will come out beautifully. And then I will get too big for my boots. And I will decide that I don't need to measure the ingredients because I will just know how much should go in. Or that if I swap that flour for this one, it will be totally fine because I know better. And surely enough, that loaf will be an unmitigated disaster. Because I decided I didn't need to rely on the recipe anymore. I'd done it so many times, I'd followed the recipe so many times, I forgot that it was the recipe that knew what it was doing, not me. When we think that we can rely on ourselves, when it becomes too easy, we forget what we should really be relying on. And I think the manna came with just enough for every day and didn't keep for longer before it went mouldy and maggoty very deliberately. God could have given them weeks worth of food, months worth of food, years worth of food. But I wonder how long it would have taken the Israelites to forget where the manna came from in the first place, if he had. We are designed to live a life of daily renewed reliance. Just like the Israelites gathering their omers of bread each morning, Jesus taught us to pray, "Give us our daily bread," each day. We are created to need to go back to God every day, to rely on him and his abundant provision. We have to go back to him fresh every day in order to allow ourselves to be fed and to be led. I think some of our need to go back to relying on God each day is also to do with the imperfect science of our memories. So, quick question. Don't worry, I'm not actually going to ask you to unmute and tell me the answer. How good is your memory? Are you somebody who loses their own glasses on top of their head and walks around the house looking for them? Are you somebody who has an encyclopedic knowledge of the past 5 years? Or, like most of us, are you somewhere in the middle of that spectrum? Wherever you fall, there is always an extent to which human memory on its own is an imperfect and unreliable thing. And I think this passage shows us two things about how, in response to God's faithful leading and feeding and abundant provision, we can remember better. Firstly, only 2 months after coming out of Egypt, after walking through the parted seas, the Israelites very much already have their rose-tinted glasses on about everything that had happened. They describe Egypt as where they sat around pots of meat and ate all the food they wanted. I don't think that that was everything that was going on in Egypt, from what I remember. That wasn't, in fact, the highlight of that story. Having lots of food was not what their lives looked like. They're not remembering the slavery they experienced, nor are they remembering who it was who rescued them from it and why. And I kind of get where they're coming from. It's easy to look back on times and places and remember them incredibly selectively. This week, I went back to Bristol for the first time since I stopped living there in August. And I had a wander around and was quite proud that I still remembered where things were, and then realised I probably shouldn't be that surprised because it wasn't that long ago. And I was, as I had some time to kill in the city, walking around to places I used to go to. And I was struck by how, not even a year later, I remember the very good, the very bad, and not a lot else about my time there. If I was honest, if you asked me about my time in Bristol, I would not give you the most glowing of reviews. But that would be far from the whole truth. It wouldn't be an accurate picture of a year, of a life lived in Bristol for a whole year, and of God's presence in that year. My memory has pressed save, as it were, on very particular parts, and it's deleted and done away with others. It's created a picture that, like any other snapshot, doesn't show everything. Similarly, the Israelites remember the food in Egypt, because that's what they're now lacking, but they seem to have forgotten the rest. And it takes an act of reliance and provision from God to give them a truer picture, a clearer memory, so that, as Moses tells them, they will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. God chooses to focus their eyes on the true picture of what happened in the past, on the reality of their situation, but also in the reality of their deliverance. He chooses to focus their eyes on what they should be remembering. I wonder if there's anything that we are looking back on, particularly maybe in this past few months, and we're misplacing our focus when we should be remembering the faithfulness of God. Secondly, God not only shows the Israelites what to remember, but also how to remember. The passage tells us this is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for generations to come, so they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the wilderness when I brought you out of Egypt. It's easy to see memory as a personal thing that each person does on their own for themselves. Just happens, right? But here, God asks a whole nation to remember. For a piece of manna to be preserved and kept, for the story of his abundant provision to be told for the generations to come. And I guess the fact that we are in a slightly bizarre situation, sat on Zoom in 2021, still talking about this, still telling the story of God's provision, means that that happened. In this case, we are the generations to come. We are blessed by this story long after it's gone out of living memory. The story that tells us about the character of God. It tells us how he builds relationships with his people, how he is faithful, and how he provides. The Israelites were called by God to tell and remember the story of his leading and his feeding, of their reliance and his provision, so that the generations to come would know the same God. Our wandering hearts and our wandering minds are forgetful. We have to reaffirm what we know to be true by sharing memory of God's faithfulness. And I'm not suggesting that what we all need to do is put some bread in a box and leave it so that people can see it in the years to come. But I am suggesting that at the moment, it feels like we are in a moment of transition from one way of hard life to hopefully another slightly different, slightly easier one. And many of us have had to rely on God for so much. I think we're stepping into a time when it will be important to remind each other and to remember what we have seen God do, the faithfulness he has shown, and his abundant provision. Where we need to choose to collectively remember his leading and his feeding. I realise I might be about to sound a little bit like I'm trying to start up a bakery. I'm not, I promise, although it would be fun. As we move towards communion and sharing bread together to remember the death of Jesus, I'd love to leave you with a couple of questions. What bread are we looking for from God? And do we believe we can rely on him for it? What bread have we already received from God? And how are we remembering it? I'd like to pray for us, and then I'm going to hand over for communion. Lord, thank you that you are a faithful God, that you show us time and time again of your abundant provision. Thank you that we see stories from thousands of years ago that show us your character today. But also that we each have stories of your faithfulness, of how we have had to rely on you and you have come through. I pray that you would give us memories to serve you, to remember your goodness, and to keep telling your stories. Amen.